What up? Welcome in. I'm Doug Gottlieb, and this is the all-new All Ball. All basketball, all the time. Max Hooper is our guest. Remember Max? He played at Oakland. He also played at St. John's and at Harvard. He's now an assistant coach in the video room for the LA Lakers, but there isn't actually a video room. It's a virtual video room. What's all that like? And wait till you hear his life story, his amazing late father, like all of these things. It's going to come together for you. He's a special dude, and I'm so honored that he would join me on this pod. I do want to get a little bit into college basketball and a little bit in the NBA. First, in college basketball, Michigan State trending up, Duke trending up. Obviously, Duke, the Jalen Johnson story has been big, and I do think that the addition by subtraction, it's what, if you coach, you understand it, when people have agendas outside of winning games, that is the making of a bad team, right? That's the making of a bad team or a making of a dysfunctional team. And the only difference between Duke now and Duke with Jalen Johnson is they have, I would guess, all the feet in the circle, as opposed to Jalen Johnson, who I'm not going to say he had both feet outside the circle, but probably 1 foot in and 1 foot in the tepid waters of the NBA. And that mentality, that inability to coach him, it's the embodiment of what sucks about basketball. It's like, I have AAU teams. If I get onto a kid, or if I bench a kid because he's not playing the way I want to play him, does his parent go like, well, I'm going to take him to another team where he plays more? Like, I'm not saying he's not going to play ever, but he's got to learn. He's got to watch other kids, the other guys that are succeeding. These things are all very important. So I think part of it is the addition by subtraction. I think you look at what Michigan State's done. They've tinkered with their lineup, and they're playing more kind of swing forwards, guys that can handle. I think that helps Rocket Watts, where when you put traditional bigs with him, I mean, can be kind of a turnover machine where he tries to prove himself too much. But also, look, Tom Izzo's won what feels like a million games, and so has Mike Krzyzewski. Did you think they ultimately wouldn't figure out the Rubik's Cube? And it's like, we so quickly, I mean, Kentucky's playing better. Yes, players do determine how good you could ultimately be. No one's ever done it without quality players. But Bill Self is the perfect example. They don't have a great team. Maybe Obagi is going to be a draft pick. I don't think anybody else. Bryce Thompson, maybe in a couple of years. He's still very young, and his body physically is not mature yet. But Kansas is going to go to the tournament. Michigan State's fighting that way. Duke is definitely trending that way. Like, these guys, Calipari's team is playing better. These guys are the best of the best, not just because they can recruit, because, damn, they can coach some ball. And I'm not sure we have a healthy enough respect. There were a lot of other coaches that were like, ha, look at those guys. They don't have players. But guess what? With those exact same players that are younger, maybe not as highly touted, they're starting to figure it out, and you don't want to play them. You know why? Because those dudes have won a ton of games. They know what they're doing. Before we get to some of the NBA stuff with Max Hooper, I want to just finish up on college basketball, because here we are just a couple weeks removed from Selection Sunday, and I feel like it's not just because I live on the West Coast. It's because I watch all hoop, and I've noticed how undervalued West Coast basketball teams are, right? Like, UCLA has done quite well when they've played out-of-conference competition, with the exception of San Diego State. Yet neither of these programs are being viewed as top four seed programs. USC, same thing, and they may have the number one pick in the upcoming NBA draft. And I think it's fascinating. Obviously, Gonzaga is and should be a one seed. And part of me wants to go back to my tweet I've put out several times, Gonzaga or the field. They're that good. But I feel like, with the exception of Gonzaga, the entire West Coast, because they haven't been able to travel east to play people and put their talents on display, is being massively undervalued. I bring that up because once we get to the NCAA tournament, I'll pick every game. Don't be surprised if some West Coast teams are underseeded and prove to be very, very viable for the second weekend and maybe beyond. All right, let's get to Max Hooper. Max was an incredible shooter. He went to two different high schools, to three different colleges. He played professionally in the G League, and now he's the video assistant for one of the video assistants for the LA Lakers. Without further ado, a proud graduate of both St. John's and Oakland University, here's Max Hooper.
Let's welcome him in. He's Max Hooper, like the perfect name for a guy who loves ball. Actually, I do the chronological order thing. We'll get to that, right? It's an interviewing technique that I learned when I was at ESPN, where the brain functions better when you start at the start, end at the end, right? But I do want to tell you what there's a couple of reasons I wanted to talk to you, but I was driving. I was driving the other day, and it was a long drive. And I was listening to the Blues Travelers, and all of a sudden blues. And I never listened to Blues Travelers. And it's like one of those, like, man, I forgot how fucking good they are. Right. And it reminded me of, this is the story I want to share with you about your dad. And we'll work our way back to all the stuff about your dad. So I used to, when I was at CBS, I used to fly from Orange County to New York every weekend, unless I had a game for like $5. And I would do the red eye. So I would do a TV show, and it was on at 9 at night, but we would tape it. So I would be done at like 8:15. And then there was a 9:26 out of Orange County, which I didn't like because it was United and they had crummy planes. So I would do the American out of LA, which was like, it was later, it was like 10:50. And then I landed be early in the morning. And I think I tweeted out at some point, like, whatever happened to John Popper or whatever. I think that's the guy's name, right? The lead singer of Blues Travelers.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't remember what it was, or was he better before he lost weight, or I don't know what it was. So all of a sudden I get a call, like it's like 6:30 in the morning. I had landed at JFK. I got a cup of Starbucks, and the car service guy, like I see the sign and I see this call, and it's like from a foreign number. It's like, hello? And it was your dad. And he was like, how are you? Great. Okay, let me tell you about John Popper, right? He's a fucking crazy person. And, you know, he had the gun charges. I was like, I don't know about what gun charges. Like, yeah, he has like some ammo thing. Anyway, your dad was getting cancer treatment in Germany.
Mm-hmm.
And he saw it on Twitter or something. And he just thought of calling me. And I didn't even realize at the time, I didn't know that he was the booking agent for them too. Like I knew about Dave Matthews Band and other stuff, whatever. And we talked probably an hour and a half. He just told stories. It was awesome. It was told stories. And he's like, you know, I have a place in Manhattan. He's like, you ever want to stay there? I was like, really? And so periodically, like he would just call me. And we start talking about music stuff and stuff in his life. And, you know, I'm sure when you're getting treatment overseas, outside of communicating with family, it's probably a pretty lonely feeling. I know he's got friends everywhere, but he was just an amazing guy in that all of a sudden I had this connection with him, which we weren't super close or anything, right? Like I met you and your dad through Miles Simon. And, but all of a sudden, like, I felt like I had this. It was like when I was a kid, I used to love to thumb through the Encyclopedia Britannica. You go to the school library and you'd be bored and you take it and you just read about shit you didn't know about. And I love music, but I don't know anything about it. And your dad would tell me about all these different artists. Anyway, so I was driving and I was thinking of Blues Travelers. And I was like, what are Maxie's up to? Anyway, what are you up to? Currently, what are you doing?
Yeah, well, currently I'm still with the Lakers this year. Last year, I was fortunate enough, and like you mentioned Miles, you know, Miles Simon, he was my connection, NBA, basketball, any competitive industry is all about relationships. So he helped me get my foot in the door last year in the video room for the Lakers. And due to COVID, they limit the number of people who are in the gym. So I'm not in LA currently, but I'm still doing my scouting remotely. I'm staring at a computer screen pretty much all night and breaking down games and sending my reports off. So grateful to still be in the mix. Obviously the Lakers, you know, one of the best organizations in history. So grateful to still be in the mix and to still be advancing my career despite the pandemic and despite the
conditions. Okay, so when you do the scouting, when you do the video stuff, do you guys self scout? Are you doing posting teams? Are you doing upcoming opponents? Are you doing college?
Preparing for upcoming opponents. So, you know, I know more about the 29 other teams than I do about the Lakers is the joke that I tell people.
I by the way, I know all these answers, just, you know, I just, yeah. It's more for people on the pod. And I had a buddy.
You got to let them know.
I had a buddy who was in Phoenix last year. He said the exact same thing. It's like, I can't tell you anything about our team. Don't ask. Like about every other team.
Yeah.
Here's a question. Again, I want to get into your story because it's a really good one. How different is what everyone runs? I think there's a prevailing thought that everybody runs the same shit. Just some people have better players. I don't share that, but I also don't study the tape of 29 other teams. How similar is what everyone does?
I would say it depends on what level of nuance you want to get to. Cause I think the building blocks are very similar because the NBA is a quick paced game, you know, where things are happening in 24 seconds. You know, your teams are not many teams are playing at a methodical pace where they're massaging their way into offense. Things happen quickly. So the quick hitters, they're all very similar, but then a lot of the, as it gets more nuanced, it's more personnel based. You know, if you have a dominant big man and another team doesn't, they're not going to run post-up actions that team with a post-up guy would run. And, you know, if you have a great isolation guard, then, you know, just it depends on what level of, you know, detail you want to get to. But on the, as a framework, a lot of teams are running very similar stuff. And it's more the stuff that happens in the flow of the game rather than really coordinated half court sets, if you will.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, like, obviously everybody's started running, you know, the spread ball screen stuff, especially now with the use of the what I call the entire floor, right? Mm-hmm. And where, you know, the weak side corner used to be kind of off limits, or the unique thing to me and is the, you know, up until 10 years ago, I feel like maybe 5 years ago, no one set a ball screen to the baseline side. It was always coming to the middle. Like for the entirety of my basketball career, it was to the middle, right?
Yeah.
You want to get it to the middle and then you want to kick to the opposite side. Well, then we started driving to the middle and throwing to the backside right behind us lifting. Now it's, hey, we can use that whole side and then hit to the other side, right? That to me is kind of the evolution of the sport and how things are changing. What's unique though, is that you work for an organization that you guys do run some of that stuff. But because it's LeBron and he's back, different era, and because it's kind of a walking mismatch, right? There's a lot of old school NBA to what you guys do in that it's just really as simple as, hey, let's get somebody who's little on LeBron and then he gets downhill and there's nothing you can do, right?
Definitely.
You're kind of still one of the few ISO dominant teams in the league, and it's more because of, like you said, personnel based, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think, yeah, like that's a luxury, you know. Other teams, they have to run more action because you don't have a guy who can just go one-on-one. But then, you know, let's say we run action and don't get what we want. Well, there's 8 seconds on the shot clock, give the ball to LeBron and then let him use his intelligence. And then also there is scheme in that, you know, and in terms of how you space on the ISOs, when you cut, the timing of when you cut, if they're screening on the weak side, because when offense gets stagnated, it's just tough to get things going. So you want to keep that flow even when you're doing things. And even with Davis, you know, when Davis is healthy, he's a great post-up threat too. So we're going to play through him as well. And like I said, that's playing to our strengths. So it is a kind of a 1990s, early 2000s style of play. But, you know, when you have the personnel to do it and then the surrounding shooters around you and cutters, then it ends up being super effective.
All right, most impressive guy you've seen on tape this year?
We just prepared for Washington. I mean, Bradley Beal's been on a whole nother level, you know. And I think maybe he doesn't get the credit he deserves just because he's on the Wizards who, you know, have been okay these past few years and haven't been, you know, made deep playoff runs. But that dude can just score the ball at an extremely high level. And he's one
of those finishes late in the game against you guys.
Yeah.
Where he lost the ball and he got it back and then he just throws it in. Like, I don't even know. Like, so many guys get discombobulated when they lose the ball, that they lose their concentration and they seek out the ball instead. But he just keeps playing and play through. He's unbelievable.
And I was just going to say that he's a dude like I think he's scored like over 30, like something crazy, like 20 of the last 23 games or something like that. There was one game he was 1 for 15, had 7 points, his lowest output of the year. Next game he came back, monster game. So he's a dude who's just unfazed. He just keeps coming at you and pretty much just does what he does. They're going to throw double teams at him. They're going to do different things to him, but he's just going to keep going. And I mean, scoring over 30 and on average in the NBA is unheard of and unreal. Yes.
It's absolutely obscene.
Fox Sports Radio has the best sports talk lineup in the nation. Catch all of our shows at foxsportsradio.com. And within the iHeartRadio app, search FSR to listen live.
What obviously, Luka, that team defensively has struggled. Yesterday, he hit two step backs. And I mean, his step back is so nice. And he's like one of those guys that like is he fat or is he thick? I can't tell. Is he fast?
Yeah.
When you watch Luka on tape, what are the notes you send your guys?
Change of pace, you know, because he doesn't have the supreme burst that, you know, a Russell Westbrook or a prime John Wall has, but the guy is never phased. He's always in control. Difficult shot maker, you know, step backs from deep, mid-range fakes. Basically, he has it all in the tool bag. And then on top of that, he's not a guy who plays with blinders on. He's a passer. And I call him a 360 passer. So, like, a lot of guys can pass in their, you know, their 90 degrees in front of them, that window. But LeBron and the Lucas, they have 360 vision. So they can – if there's a guy who's open behind this shoulder, they're going to find him and know how to deliver that pass rather than just, you know, what's in front of them and just the simple play. And they you know, Luka's vision is incredible. Really, really. I can't even imagine playing with him. What it's like, just get to the right spot. The ball is going to find you, you know, just put yourself in that spot.
No, that's what I used to tell guys all the time. It's just like, you get there and it's okay. If you're open and you don't get it, you can get mad. It's okay. I'll get to you eventually. You know,
just put your hands right here. The ball will find it.
Just put your hand, the ball will find you. Did Jamal Murray, like what he did in the bubble, and we've seen some of it here recently, but it felt like whatever happened in the bubble, like I did not know he had that in him. Like there were moments of it, but it's like you talk about Brad Beal, the consistency of it. What was your reaction to seeing Jamal Murray kind of take it to that different level in the bubble last year?
Putting up incredible numbers and similar things to Beal, just relentless, you know, just unfazed, you know, if something doesn't go right, if he makes a turnover, he's just coming right back at you. And that's how most of the best players are. But that bubble was kind of like the bubble, because it was so unique and it was short lived. It was like defining moments for people. You know, you think about Jamal Murray, obviously the Lakers making big statements, even the Suns going 8-0. They ultimately, they didn't make the playoffs, but you know, making a run like that, like Murray came out, he made a heck of a statement. And I mean, he's been a great player, and now I think he's just going to continue to, you know, take it to a higher level.
What impressed me about LeBron in the bubble last year, at times this year, this year has been hard just because now you got injuries, you got to carry him, right? And so the defense isn't as good. But what I've noticed, and again, you break down the film, and I know you know more about other teams, but what I've noticed is he's smarter in that he doesn't guard the ball nearly as much as he used to. I don't want any of that smoke, right? But he's back there quarterback in center field. And all of those other guys' levels of intensity on defense were so raised. It was like, this is our identity. When you prepare, like, so for people who in the industry, they know what you do, but when you prepare, like you pour over all the synergy, all the different games, you provide notes. What's that like to work with a group and give, and then all of a sudden you see the MVP, the best player in the league, execute what you advise them on? Like, hey, this shit actually works. If the best player, like the whole thing is about the best player buying in, right? You are who your best player is. And when he buys in, what's that like to see him execute the defensive game plan?
Right. Well, I mean, just to touch on that, it's like, I think just to touch on the role in general, like as a former player, former college player, briefly played in the G League, you know, you think you know the game and you think you have an IQ and an understanding, but when it becomes your job and you're spending, you know, probably between 10 and 20 hours on each team, like, so with the way the process works is we watch the five games leading up to our game on each team, you know.
I do the same thing about the broadcaster, by the way. I advise people to do the exact same thing. Watch the last 5 games.
You learn the trends, you learn, you know, who's playing well. Sometimes there's a lineup changes. Like, for example, we have Portland coming up. I've been scouting Portland. CJ McCollum hasn't been in the lineup, so there's going to be some different things. You know, different guys are going to be playing more minutes. But it's – there's a – you just are kind of noting trends, noting what's going on, and giving your coaching staff the information they need to make decisions on, okay, this is what's happening. This is the information. How are we going to game plan? How are we going to strategize? What defensive scheme should we use? How have other teams guarded them, and has it worked? Has it not worked? And then on the other flip side, how do we attack them? Where are they weak defensively? How can we exploit that? So it's basically just having a detailed approach and giving them answers to the test, and then they decide how to implement that. And just a quick you know, story on being around LeBron. When I was around LeBron in person last year,
yeah,
and his level of communication and intensity and basketball IQ, like in practice, or shoot arounds or walkthroughs, just pretty much in terms of knowing what's going on, it was just like, it was basically like a savant, you know, like he just pretty much, like you said, was orchestrating. And what you see in the game, it was only heightened in practice when we would scrimmage in practice, and he would really bring it and be locked in. It was on another level, just crazy communication, anticipation, knowing exactly what's going to happen on the court long before it even does.
Okay, so give me the skinny on Portland on Damian Lillard. Like, it used to be not a great finishing package, right?
Yeah.
And then you could go at him some defensively. He seems like he's finishing better because it feels like it's something like everybody, we fall in love with the deep threes, right? And he obviously, mm-hmm. working with Phil, he's developed a series of shots in which, like, I actually think his Luka and his, like, he does that sidestep, which is, and he does it quick, and it's so awkward and yet so good. Like, I sent you that video of my son hitting a game winner, right?
That was,
it's
unreal.
One of those, like, it was sweet, but it's one of those, like, I've been working with him, like, hey dude, mm-hmm. this stuff works. Mm-hmm. You got a bigger dude on you, just one step to the side and up and go. And it's different than how we were taught in terms of shooting a step back and whatever. When you try and break down Damian Lillard, what are the keys to try and slow him down? You're not going to stop.
Yeah. I mean, the guy is a relentless scorer, but I think to your point, I think if my advanced stats are correct, he's shooting a career high at the rim this year. So he is finishing at a higher level than he ever has been. And the deep three, I mean, the four pointers, as we call them, you know, beyond 30 feet, he's pulling up off the dribble with like their layups. You know, I think the only guys that really come to mind who consistently do that are Steph and Trae Young and Lillard. So that's something that is unique. So your point of pickup has to be higher. You can't, you know, pick him up with your heels on the 3-point line, because that thing is going up. And he killed us in the first game. I think 7 threes, I forget his point total, but really came at us. So for us, it's about, you know, making him, like you said, you're not going to shut the guy down. I mean, he's you know, all-star starter. He's relentless. You know, he's that.
Not an all-star starter. I mean, they're pissed about it.
Reserve, excuse me.
Not an all-star starter. I know. I'm just, yeah. I'm messing with you. Like, these guys, I don't want to play in the all-star game, but I want to be a starter. Like,
yeah. It's always, you always want a little more, you know?
I got it. I mean, look, I'm guilty of it. We all are, as competitive people. And 100%. I do understand it. You want to be recognized as elite.
Yeah.
You know, but it's fascinating to me on these guys. It's like, at some point you go like, hey, I'm in the all-star game. It's for good. You know?
Yeah.
It's like the Seinfeld with McDonald's, you know, billions and billions served. At some point you just go, McDonald's, we're doing pretty well. Right.
We served a lot of them. Yeah. Well, I guess one last thing to note about Dame that makes him unique is he loves to pull up off the dribble right when you're on him and try to draw the foul. So for me, I think it's my job to highlight things that make a guy unique. You know, like if a guy's scoring out of pick and roll, it's not just, all right, what does he do? Like everyone scores out of pick and roll. You know, like what does he do that's specific? Like you said, the sidestep is something to note, and it's a short, quick sidestep. It's not like how I was taught on pull-ups and separation, cover as much ground as possible.
Right.
I'm going to cover as much ground as I can, but I'm going to do it slowly. So let me just cover a tiny bit of ground, but do it in a split second. Then I'm going to get my shot off. So that's what he does. He pulls up off the dribble, looking to draw the foul. So the lean in, something to be aware of. And then finishing at a career high level at the rim. So, you know, challenge him at the rim. And you can't foul him because he shoots 90 plus from the free throw line. So tough cover.
Yeah, have fun. Well, it's one of the things that it's like, you know, I've told, I've when I've done the draft stuff, it's like, you can, it, and now it's really hard to hide anybody defensively, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, just the way in which basketball has evolved. It's not just about mismatches. You know, they'll move you around, slide a hand, then all of a sudden, boom, they put you in a ball. So you're like, whoa, wait a second. How'd they get that? Like, yeah, that was the whole design, was to get your worst defender on their best player. It's hard to hide anybody. But I think it's much harder to hide a guard.
100%.
Dudes are in, are starting for a in the NBA for a reason. They are, you know.
Every
night, imagine being a rookie guard. Imagine being a rookie guard. You're like, okay. Tonight I guard Steph. Tomorrow night I guard Damian Lillard. Then maybe some Donovan Mitchell. Oh, then you got Jamal Murray. Like, hey, have fun. You have to be, and if you have a bad night, better get ready for the next night. Like, it's crazy. Yeah. You were a great shooter. Great shooter. When you watch the tapes, who's the best shooter? Just in terms of shooter. Like, what I like about Steph is everybody says he's the best shooter ever. Like, I don't think enough people contextualize it. This is my personal opinion. You've watched more on tape. Some guys can go right. Some guys can go left. Some guys are catch and shoot. Like, Sadale Three used to play for the Lakers when I was a kid. But in between, before they got Kobe and they had after Magic, I actually liked those teams. Nick Van Exel and Vlade was still there, right? And Sadale Three, if he dribbled the ball with his left hand, it was going in. And any other way, it probably wasn't going in, right? Tony Parker, similarly, always pounded it once with his left hand before each. When he do that, it was going in most times, right? Steph, I feel like he can go either way and catch and shoot. But in terms of best shooter you've seen in breaking down tape, who would be the one that you would say?
I mean, Steph is the easy answer, obviously, because he's so versatile. And like you said, it doesn't matter catch and shoot, doesn't matter deep, doesn't matter off balance, left, right, pretty much doesn't matter. I mean, he might shoot slightly better going right than left, but it's really probably not much of a difference. But, I mean, I'll probably take two guys, if that's okay. This season, Duncan Robinson and Joe Harris. I mean, I just saw Joe Harris's shot chart, and I believe he shoots 70% from the left corner three. So that's sickening. You know what I mean? Like, and he shoots 62% or 60 something percent at the rim. So he shoots a corner three better than he does layups. And
Here's what's amazing about that. So we have a Dr. Dish in my house, right? So, you know, like, you're trying to encourage your kids or other kids, like, hey, look, you know, best shooter in the world, they shoot 50% from the field, right? At best, 50% from the field. He shoots 70% from a corner three in games. Okay. That's not like all these dudes, you go into an empty gym and it's whack, whack, they're shooting 80 and 90, right? Like, crazy of numbers. Course. 70% in games it's ridiculous. There's another R word we don't use anymore. That's what it is. Like, it's just so mind-blowingly amazing.
With NBA players guarding you, getting paid millions and millions and millions. Your job is to stop this guy from doing this, and he's still doing it, you know. And his role has changed a bit, you know, with the new context. Obviously, with their team, his shots are coming differently.
Michigan didn't start him. And they think that's why they went to the Final Four, because they were so good defensively.
100%, you know. But, I mean, I have no regrets with my career. You know, I gave it everything I had, so I definitely have no regrets. But
None?
I mean, I did everything I could in my power, you know. So
yes,
certain things just work out the way they're supposed to work out. But you best believe, as a part of, when I was in person, at least a part of my coaching role, you know, sometimes it was my job to hop in scout team, you know, so we're preparing for the Rockets. I got the green light to go out there and let it fly. So that was fun. But like, Miles had me as PJ Tucker and Daniel House said, anytime you catch it, just fire it. So I got to do that. And, you know, obviously playing in the NBA was my dream, but now, you know, being a coach, like, my passion has shifted to being the best coach I can. And if I can add value doing that and I still have that skill, then, you know, I'm happy to do it and happy to contribute. So I had a chance to work out with Duncan Robinson in 2016. It was following his sophomore year. So really hadn't established himself at the level he's been at. And we did have some pretty epic shooting battles. So that was fun. And he, I mean, he grew since then. I mean, I think he's all of 6'8" now. And now he's really figured out how to make it work defensively while also he knows all the tricks of the trade, how to get his shot off, throw the ball out there, misdirection, change direction, shot fakes. It's a work of art to watch him as a shooter.
Okay. So the story I wrote a long time ago was you fell in love with basketball. Was it Salt Lake hotel room and the Jazz were on?
Yeah, that sounds about, my dad and I were on a skiing trip. So somewhere in Utah, probably somewhere in Utah.
Park City.
Something. Yeah, I would imagine so. And this is when the Jazz, Karl Malone, John Stockton, the greatest team in the world, or second greatest team in the world, I suppose at the time, they had a blowout late at night. And I said, man, had never watched a basketball game before. I said, this is the greatest team ever, right? Like, who could be better? They just won by 50 points. And, you know, whatever it was, 4, 5, 6 year old Max, that was my reality right there. So that's where the love of the NBA, I suppose, was born.
Okay, so how did you foster that? You're in Carmel, California, which, you know, it's beautiful. But it's,
gorgeous area.
It's an incredible area, right? These cypress trees, a beautiful little downtown. You grew up playing basketball where? Was there like, I know we'll get to high school in a second, but as a little kid, where'd you hoop?
There was the YMCA League. But I mean, in that area, you know, the sports as a whole aren't that strong. So, I mean, I was dominating the YMCA League or the rec center league. But then once I got to getting closer to high school, late in middle school, I started doing AAU up in the Bay Area. That's where more competition was. So getting involved in that. But for me, it started in the backyard, just shooting and shooting and shooting and shooting and shooting on my own. You know, my dad didn't play. My mom didn't. I didn't have a last name Hooper, but no one in my family played basketball. And I didn't really have buddies at school who played. So it was really just me watching NBA games and then going outside and just shooting, shooting, shooting.
You're basically like a Euro. That's how Euros grow up, right? They grow up.
Yeah.
They just grow up shoot. How did you learn to shoot the basketball? Like, because your shot was pure. Was it always that way? Or did you learn? Did somebody teach you? Did you go to a camp? Like, how did you learn the proper way? Because your shot is pretty much fundamentally perfection.
Yeah. For me, it was kind of self-taught. I did. I worked with some trainers, but it wasn't so much on shooting form. I was kind of the kid early on. I had a bit of a funky shot and people would, you know, I was making them. So coaches wouldn't really touch it. Wouldn't really mess with
funky
it.
Shot. Meaning what?
A lot of the left hand involvement. So the thumb flick in it and a bit of like a chest release rather than, you know, up more towards the eyebrow. So, but it was,
so my thing was, so I Miles can attest to this. Okay? Mm-hmm. We're in fourth grade, first ever NJB championship at Fullerton College, where Walt used to work dudes out. Right.
Of course.
And I beat Miles. They had at halftime of the fourth grade championship, me, our team against Miles' team. We had a 3-point shooting contest and I beat him. And I used to shoot the ball and I would thumb it, but it would like tap the ball. And so I had a little bit of Saturn rotation, you know, and I think Anthony Davis actually has that too, right? He's got a little bit of that Saturn rotation, a lot of side spin rotation. Yeah. Yeah. But mine was, but it went in. And then, you know, when I got, it wasn't until high school when I fixed it, right? I took the thumb off it. So that's where I am kind of with my son, where he, for 11 and for a little 11-year-old, he shoots it pretty well left-handed. He gets his thumb a little bit into it. But I do think that, you know, it's about, we'll eventually get it there, get it where his hand's behind the ball. He's not strong enough yet, but it's pretty good, pretty well one-handed. It gets there. But it is interesting on how, you know, Ray Allen would, he'd occasionally get that thumb into it, you know. Reggie Miller, like, watch how he shoots. Like, he actually funky. Used two fingers. Right?
Totally funky. Yeah. His follow through actually finishes like this.
Yes. And you're like, what? Like, one of the greatest shooters ever. That doesn't make any sense. Whereas Clay and Steph are as pure as the driven snow. Right. Like, that's
absolutely.
Like, and that's how there's, okay. So, you get into like middle school and how did the conversation take place with your dad? Like, hey, I want to go play at like a high school, not in Carmel.
Yeah, I think the writing was always on the wall, like, because I always had lofty goals with basketball. Like I mean, here I am today. I'm working with the Lakers. Like, I always knew basketball was what I wanted to do. And I think my dad, like, whether we had a direct conversation or not about it, it was just like playing in Carmel was, it just wasn't going to challenge me appropriately. And I think, you know, you can't, you know, determine what your kids pursue, but if you know whatever your kids pursue, you want to help them and give them whatever tools you can. And for me, it was just like I was the big fish in the little pond, and so I just needed to find a bit bigger pond. And so, I mean, obviously my family made a ton of sacrifices, and I'm always grateful for that. Both my parents and my sister made a ton of sacrifices for me to be able to try to pursue higher levels of the game and challenge myself more and more and more, and basically maximize myself at every step I could, because staying at, like, I think the Monterey County area puts out one D1 player probably every 5 years or so. And then, you know, I went to, even San Jose was a step up. Like, the league I played in San Jose, pretty much each team had at least 0 to 2 Division I players. And then modern day, obviously another step up, and then end up at Brewster Academy playing with 3 NBA players on my team. So it was like, it was always, you know, seeking out higher levels of competition just to bring the best out of myself. And, for my dad, he was just willing and ready at every step of it. You know, not all kids have that. And I now I look back and I have a lot more perspective, and just super, super grateful that he was able to afford me the opportunities that he did.
Yeah. It's a hard, as a dad, it's a hard thing as a kid, because my dad kind of same thing, right? Where he would do anything. Hey, take you to any workout. My dad's like, it's interesting. We lost a team from Bakersfield, and we had practice last night, and my son, and we lost him like 3 weeks ago. And my son was, he's like, how far is Bakersfield? And he put it in the maps. He's like, man, they drove 2 hours and 45 minutes to play. And I was like, how about this one? When I was in high school, J.R. Henderson was our AAU teammate. J.R., of course, is just got done playing in Japan. Now he's professional women's coach in Japan. And he used to come to practice. My dad was like, I can't play him unless he comes to practice. You know, it's really interesting to me that my dad used to drive like an hour and a half and meet his dad an hour away. And when his dad would drive like an hour, so they could drop JR off, take him to practice, and drive him back. And his dad would, I don't like, wait there or whatever. And just the sacrifice that dads make. And I think what happens is, like, my only desire as a dad is to give him every opportunity he can, but also for him to just, like, at some point go like, hey man, thanks. You know?
Yeah.
And I don't know if I did that enough to my dad, but I think he does. He has pretty good perspective as a kid, and you have great perspective. So for people who don't know, so your dad was the booking agent for Dave Matthews Band, right? But it's more than that. Like, he didn't just like have them hand delivered to him. He discovered them at like a college bar, right?
Yeah. I mean, it was 1994, I believe, or 93, 94. He was a young agent, you know, just like a young hustler in basketball, a young hustler in broadcasting, a young hustler in anything. You know, you got to go make it happen if you want to make it happen. And it's not just going to fall in your lap. So there had been some buzz, you know, the Dave Matthews Band, but, like, you know, still playing bars and clubs at colleges, and, you know, they hadn't established themselves or anything. So it's kind of like sort of the equivalent of, you know, an agent, you know, building, or I guess that's like illegal, but because basketball has so many rules, but, you know, it's the agent equivalent of finding a kid in seventh grade before anyone knows they're going to be a stud. And, you know,
so what did he tell you about it?
I mean, I was 2 at the time, so.
I know, but he's told the story, because he told me the story.
Yeah.
Right? I mean,
that story. Yeah, so my mom, we were living in California, but we were in New York over the New Year's, I think, or holidays. And he went to Winston-Salem, North Carolina, saw Dave Matthews Band at a bar called Ziggy's at Wake Forest, and was like, basically called my mom and was like, I think it was New Year's, was like, you know what? I need to stay here one more night. This band has a chance to change our life. You know, this band is incredible, and they're going to do huge things. And this was before they had done anything. And now we're here almost 30 years later. And, like, Dave Matthews is still, obviously the pandemic put a hitch in it, but still rolling just as strong as ever in terms of touring. And had their career has been one of the greatest, I would say, of modern music.
How were they to you?
Whenever my dad would bring me to the concerts, it was always, well, for anyone who knew my dad, he liked to talk. So he would always talk about myself, my sister, you know. So they always knew me before, knew about what was going on with me before I even had spoken with them. But the band was always great. Dave, you know, if I see him, we'll always have a brief conversation, you know, always great people. And then Carter Beauford, the drummer, really, really loves to chat if you catch him at a good time. So all, you know, nothing but good things to say about those guys.
Do they, Darius Rucker's a good friend of mine. So they take a Jim Beam shot before they go out on stage. It's like their tradition. What's the Dave Matthews Band tradition before they go out?
I'm not sure. I'm close enough in the inner circle. I don't know. I don't know what it would be. When I would go to the shows, I would be with my dad, but he would be working, you know, so he'd always be busy. And I would say Dave Matthews, they're pretty private. They're private guys. So before the shows, they're all just kind of in their tour buses and just, you know, laying low. And then they come out and rock the world when they come out on stage. So hopefully we can get back to that. This is making me think about concerts. Hopefully we can get back.
Okay. Yeah. So first concert you're going to go to is him. And you don't have to say Dave Matthews Band. It's okay. You've been to a million of them.
Yeah. I mean, well, see now my fiance, she loves Dave Matthews. So it'd probably be Dave or scheduling is so crazy. So whatever, at this point I would say I'm not picky because I want to get out to a concert, obviously safely, do it safely, but I want to get out. So Dave would be great.
Okay. Coolest venue you've been to watch a concert.
Yeah. Well, the something that's super, super cool. The Gorge is an incredible venue in kind of the middle of nowhere in Washington State. But because my dad was in the music industry for so long, and same with basketball industry, everyone gets to know everyone. And I think he was really widely respected by a lot of different people. And they, after he passed, Dave Matthews plays the Gorge pretty much every Labor Day. And they named a viewpoint at the Gorge, the Chip Hooper view. And my sister and I, this was Labor Day, 2016. We unveiled like this plaque, an engraving of my dad. And because a lot of people didn't know that my dad was a photographer, a really fine art photographer. And so there's a picture of him with fancy view camera looking out on the view. And it's pretty cool. So coolest venue by far.
Okay. Better than Red Rocks. I've never been to either.
I haven't been to Red Rocks. So it looks incredible and it's on my list, but can't include it because I haven't been.
Okay. Hollywood Bowl is really cool. I mean, I understand it's not as aesthetically and, you know, whatever, mm-hmm. but Hollywood Bowl is pretty dope. Santa Barbara Bowl also very cool. Okay. So you're at a small Christian school in San Jose and you decide I'm going to go to Mater Dei.
Mm-hmm.
So your dad's like, all right, gets a place in Irvine. You go to Mater Dei. You show up at Mater Dei. You're a junior in high school.
And I only went there 1 year, senior year
in high school. Yeah. Who's on your team?
The top players were Tyler Lamb, Keala King, Gary Franklin, and Caden Reinhart. High level, you know, D1 players, Pac-12 or equivalent levels.
Now, did you talk to them before you showed up, or just like, I'm here?
Briefly, I knew them from playing on the AAU circuit a little bit, but I didn't know those guys well. And Keala King also transferred in. So we kind of had to get chemistry put together quickly because it was similar to AAU, you know, where you slap a team together and you guys got to figure it out rather than coming up, you know, through 9th, 10th, 11th, like all the way playing through with the same guys in a more traditional sense.
What was that like to play? Gary McKnight's won more games than anybody in the history of California basketball. You're playing with all these dudes and now you're playing these like made up games and you're everybody's biggest game. What was that like?
It was like to that point, it was like the highest level I had played at. AAU is different. But high school, I feel like there's so much more pride in winning and, you know, protecting the modern day tradition and stuff like that. And, you know, when you walk in the modern day gym, there's championship, championship, championship banners, you know, everywhere. And, you know, you want to do your part in creating your legacy. And I only had 1 year to create my legacy there. So I wanted to, you know, leave a mark and also just develop as a player. You know, every day you're that was the best to that point. That was the best group of players I got to practice with collectively on a day in and day out basis. And I love playing more than anything. You know, just competing. So it was fun to just compete with those guys every day. And like you said, modern day tradition, you come in with a target on your back. So every game, even if it was a team that wasn't that talented, they're bringing everything they got at you. And we didn't get our state championship. You know, we lost in the semifinals, but I believe 32-2, had a great season and had a lot of fun doing it. You know, it was a really, you try to pursue these goals and do everything you can, but you want to look back, have fun memories on, you know, I'm glad I had that experience. I'm grateful for that experience.
What led you go to Brewster?
I think Brewster Academy, like the reason why I wanted to do a fifth year was I was a bit of a late bloomer. You know, I was skinny. I mean, I was always skinny throughout my career, you know, but definitely a late bloomer. And I had grown, not that it was like Anthony Davis had grown to 6'11", but, you know, I had grown like 3 inches between my sophomore and senior year. So I was still growing into my body and still needed to do some physical maturing. And I had some options to go to college, but I felt like going and doing an extra year to just prepare more would have been beneficial. And Jason Smith, similar to Gary McKnight, what he's done, he hasn't done it quite as long program at Brewster. And I weighed a couple options and felt like being at Brewster was the best fit, best challenge, best opportunity for me to keep pursuing my goals of playing at, you know, the highest level I could in college and then playing beyond.
Okay, so who was at Brewster when you were there?
Well, the guys who people might remember, Jakar Sampson, currently on the Pacers, Mitch McGarry, first round draft pick to the Thunder, Deontay Burton played on the Thunder. So those three NBA players, and then other guys who played, pretty much all high level guys. Nadir Tharp, who played at Kansas, Marcus Kennedy, who played at Villanova and SMU, Eli Carter, who played at Florida and BC, Deron Johnson, who played at Pittsburgh. Yeah, so a ton of talent.
I mean,
you know, loaded. Yeah.
What was that? Where is that? That's in New Hampshire, right?
Bro, New Hampshire. Yeah.
What was that like?
I can point it out on the map, finally.
What was that like?
I mean, kind of like I said earlier, you know, going to modern day was the highest level I had played at then. Like, a good Brewster story is I showed up the first day we had orientation. And it's funny because you're at a school, you have to wear a coat and tie every day. I don't think they do it anymore, but you had to wear a coat and tie. So we got all these tall basketball studs at a tiny boarding school in New Hampshire. And then a bunch of just other normal students, you know, because there was a lot of talent on that roster. And that was just every day you got to compete, because otherwise it's just like, you're just left behind, you know? And I think that type of environment is what raises kids now that I've, you know, now that I'm you know, I have more perspective on it. Like, I've seen kids who go into that environment and some of them fold because they don't have that competition, they don't have that fire within to bring it every day. And the ones who rise to the occasion and thrive in those situations are the ones who, you know, have long-term success typically.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so why did you go to Harper?
At that time, an opportunity to attend Harvard, tremendous honor, opportunity to be a part of a basketball program that was on the up and up, trending upwards. It was just something I didn't feel like I could turn down. Felt like at the time I trusted myself, it was the best opportunity. And, you know, I'm able to say I got into Harvard. You know, I have that on my resume. And again, grateful for all my experiences, you know, because that was a unique one for sure.
What was it? Give me one Harvard story, like, that you haven't told people about just going to school at Harvard.
Oh, yeah. Like just the type of people you're around, you know, like going from Brewster Academy or modern day, you know, just basketball. Some of the basketball players aren't the sharpest tools in the shed, you know, but then you show up and you're in a Harvard class and like, I don't even remember what they asked, but like someone asked a question. I didn't even understand the question, you know, like that the person asked, much less the answer that he was going to get. And it was like one of my sociology classes or something like that. Just being around excellence in everything, academically, and then And then basketball was trending upwards. You know, it was the first time, the team that I played on was the first time that Harvard made the tournament. Harvard at the time, that was the beginning of a run of dominating the Ivy League. So it was about being a part of greatness in terms of on the court and off the court.
One thing you take away from playing for Tommy Amaker?
His organization, like super practice was always super organized, regimented. Everything was it was like my first exposure to a high level, like coach who was super tied together and who was, because when you go from high school to college, you know, there's the scouting reports, there's just different, there's, you know, organized practice plan, just different, just, it was the highest level of organization I had been around and professionalism as a coach. And I mean, there's a reason why he's had success. I don't even know how many years he's been there, probably 10 plus now. And he's been super, super successful. So it was my first time being exposed to that. Learned a lot from that too.
Okay. So you decide to leave. So you tell your parents, I'm chasing this basketball dream. I want to leave. Like, you're at the greatest academic school in the United States, maybe the best in the world.
Yeah.
You say, I want to go to St. John's because Jakar Sampson's there and I know some guys and they need a shooter, right?
Yeah.
How'd that conversation go at home?
As always, my dad was 100% behind me. You know, he wanted me to pursue my basketball dream as best I could. And I think he always knew that, like, I would end up in a role that I'm in now, you know, that I would be in coaching, that basketball was my dream and my passion. And I wish I could have been able to, you know, feel comfortable about staying at Harvard, just weather that storm. And, you know, but I think at the time you make decisions, you trust yourself and you live with the results. And so I was going to go for it. I was going to pursue it as best I could. I was going to shoot for the stars and give it everything I had. So going to St. John's, it was just, I felt like I could compete at that level. I felt like I filled a need that team needed. And, you know, I took on that challenge, spent 2 years there and pretty much gave it everything I had and left it all out there. And, if I wasn't going to be good enough, you know, I was just gonna have to live with that.
You mentioned regimented. Lab runs a little different, little different ship in comparison to Tommy. What is that like though, to go from a guy, you know, Tommy's buttoned up, everything's to Lab, which is, you know, and that's not, he's much more relaxed. And then the type of guys you're around are very, very different, right? It's much more like Brewster than it is like Harvard. What was that change like for you?
Yeah. I mean, I feel like I love that environment because those practices, we would do some drills, some breakdown drills, but it was really just a war every day. It was just kind of, you know, roll the balls out. Let's hoop. Let's scrimmage. 3-on-3, 2-on-2. And then let's put in a couple actions and let's just run it up and down. So those, I mean, that was competing with guys like Jakar Sampson, Dom Pointer, D'Angelo Harrison, Phil Green, a lot of guys who still play professionally. Yeah. Jakar Sampson still in the NBA. Dom Pointer knocking on the NBA. I think he got a 10-day last year knocking on the NBA door. Harrison playing overseas. Phil Green still plays overseas. So, I mean, high-level athletes and just – that was just about – it was a bloodbath pretty much every day in practice. Like, if you didn't bring it there, you were going to get embarrassed because extremely athletic, aggressive players who needed to refine their skill sets but had the raw athleticism and played hard and played with intensity every day. Again, it was a new environment for me, similar to Brewster Academy. But when you're in college, you know, all hell breaks loose a little bit. You know, high school is a little bit more safer environment. You know, college is a little more cutthroat. So
better to go to school in New York or Boston?
Well, both are great cities. I live in Boston now, so I love Boston. But both schools are great. The only problem about St. John's is you're still a little isolated from Manhattan. Obviously, it would be cool to be in Manhattan, but you only end up going there so often because you're so busy as a student athlete. But both are great. Harvard's a little closer to Boston, so I'll say Boston.
Okay. 2 years, and then you're like, all right, now I got my degree. Now I want to go hoop. And you went to Oakland, and they had actually recruited you originally at a Brewster, at Travis Bader at the time. Right. So what was it like to go from you didn't really play at Harvard, you play some at St. John's, to now like kind of a guy at Oakland. How long did it take for you to kind of get your sea legs to feel like, okay, I'm, because you'd practiced against all these guys, but playing in games is completely different. What was that first year like?
The first year was up and down. And, you know, I had huge expectations for myself because I was like, man, I'm finally going to get the opportunity. You know, I'm finally playing with a coach who kind of fosters what I do and encourages me to do what I do. And it was up and down, a bit disappointing, you know, just because it was up and down and couldn't quite get my footing. I'd have a great game and then, you know, disappear for a couple games. So it was that was part of my growth as a player, you know, figuring it out. And every year up until Harvard, I had played basketball. You know, I was part of the rotation. I always played. You know, it was playing time was never really a thought. You know, modern day, I started every game. High school, I started every game. Brewster came off the bench, but played and, you know, played a lot of minutes in every game. Harvard, all of a sudden, no minutes. So right. I think a lot of kids go through that too when they, you know, early in their career, you know, you kind of, unless you're number one, if you're a one and done or if you're playing on a horrible team, that's pretty much the only way freshmen play typically in college. And it was freshman and sophomore. So it was an adjustment for me, but then I was thrown into the fire and kind of learned trial by error. And then finally, like after that junior year, I felt like I was, you know, pretty much ready to roll for my senior year.
Okay. So you had this unbelievable stat, right, of when you played, of not taking 2-point shots, right? You took, let's see here, you didn't take one your senior year, not one. Well, you shot 26 free throws. You act like that you got all these, you got clipped on all you get, but you made 25. Do you remember the free throw that you missed?
It was early. I was mad, man. I got fouled on a three and I made 2 of 3. I think I should have made them all, you know?
Abilene Christian.
Yeah. Yeah,
Abilene Christian. That's the missed free throw. Abilene Christian in a tournament early in the year.
Man.
You did, like, when you're in Oakland, you guys used to play everybody, right? Like, I remember you played, I'm looking now, you played Michigan State and Washington, Virginia. Was there a moment where you're like, okay, now I made it, right? Like, you're the Big East, you played big boys, whatever, but now you're actually playing big minutes, 25, 26 minutes a game. Was it different when you played against Michigan State, having been through all your travels?
Yeah, it was like once I got to my senior year, and you know, we haven't even touched on it, but like my dad was sick, you know, it was like this is what I had worked for. Like I just wanted to play, and then I'm at Oakland University, the coach is screaming at players to get me the ball, you know, like the system was set up for me to be successful as a shooter. And I mean, recruiting tactics, like if you're not getting recruited to the highest level of college and you're a 3-point shooter, like I don't know why you wouldn't consider Oakland, you know what I mean? It's what he does. He wants his shooters to get shots. The offense is designed for his shooters to get shots. It's a setup, you know what I mean? It's a setup if you're a shooter. Like it's not by accident that Travis Bader shot 363s. It's not by accident that I shot 256. It's not by accident that Kendrick Nunn averaged 12 3-point attempts. Like it's designed. And so I mean, for me, it was what I had worked for. And it was like the perfect marriage, a coach who believed in what I did. I had Kay Felder on my team, kid who's trying to not only lead the country in scoring, but lead the country in assists too. So he's trying to get people involved. I had Jalen Hayes with me, who's an all-league big man, setting me great screens. And it was just kind of like basically a setup for me to be the best shooter I could be. But not just because it was a cool thing to do, but because that would help us win games.
It's the thing of being a fit. Right. Like you just, it's gotta be a fit. And if you go somewhere, it's not a fit, then you got to find somewhere that is, it's kind of the story of people's lives. When did you find out your dad was sick?
Well, I found out my dad was sick. He had cancer in October, 2011. So freshman year of Harvard, he gave me a call and let me know that he had cancer and that the prognosis wasn't very good. So that was, you know, we've talked about on here, you know, you've kind of talked about how important my dad was to me. It was earth shattering for me and transformative, just kind of changed my perspective on everything.
So I guess the question becomes though, he's sick. Is he in California? Because and I know he had a place in Manhattan. I'm just wondering, was it ever like, dude, I got to go be close to him when I'm open?
No, I think it was always, our basketball journey, like pursue basketball. Like that was always my answer, you know. He was traveling a lot. And then once I got to St. John's, he was living part-time in Manhattan. So we saw each other a ton then. But it was always pedal to the metal because I knew that's what he wanted me to do. I knew that he wanted me to pursue that. And that was my outlet, you know, that was my sanctuary, really. I mean, any athlete knows, you know, that sacred sanctuary where you kind of escape from the world and from your struggles. But I also knew that doing well in basketball and pursuing it as hard as I could was making him proud. So I think that was always my answer when I was dealing, like whenever I was going through hard times or whatever, in terms of seeing him struggle.
Your senior year, there was the moment, was your senior night game when he was there.
Yeah.
He was actually in a hospital bed.
The 24th, almost two days, 26th. It was 2 days, 5 years ago to the day almost.
Right. So it'll be when we'll drop this on that day.
Perfect.
Okay. So what do you remember?
That was a whirlwind. We're number one. The game was important. We needed to win that game because that would, if we won, it would clinch us a bye in the Horizon League tournament. So number one, game's big deal. We're playing our rival too. Detroit, University of Detroit, we're playing our rival. Senior night, the team was, we were a good team. You know, we were one of the top teams in the conference. It was so kind of a lot at stake. And then the night before, he called me and actually woke me up. We would stay in a hotel the night before, even home games, we would stay the night before. And he woke me up in the hotel, let me know that I would, that he would be there. I was like a little foggy or whatever, just because I had just woken up. And then like, once I like hung up the phone, I was like, shit, he's like, he's going to be there. And I was like super fired up, but still try to, you know, stay calm, keep, you know, do my routine. And, you know, just because I wanted to play well, was excited to see him. And then we win the game. I play pretty well. And it was senior night, so I give a little speech. There's a little ceremony. And then ESPN caught it where after the game, I just skip the handshake lines and I run up into the crowd. And then he was actually in a hospital bed in the stands. And it was like an indescribable moment. And I'm fortunate enough that, you know, there's cameras on it that captured it. And so I can always look back at it and just have great memories from special night, you know, special night, once in a lifetime type of opportunity.
What were the, I apologize if this is too personal. What were your last conversations like?
Yeah. I mean, at the time you don't know it's going to be the last conversation. So he passed 8 days later. But at the time we just, honestly, you know, he told me, he said like, and it was me, Kay Felder, and I think Sharon Dorsey Walker. He said, hey, when I get this taken care of, when I'm all better, I'll just come back in the summer. I'll take you guys out to eat. That'll be cool. Right. And like, he was just like, I mean, he was like, had such a fighting spirit, and he was really not in a good place health-wise. You know, he was really, really struggling, but.
Did you know how bad it was?
I didn't know. Like, obviously I knew he was not doing well at all. I knew he had a stroke. I mean, he was bedridden, but I didn't know he was going to pass in a week. You know, I thought I hope I had a year. I hope I had 6 months or something like that, you know? But like, yeah, our conversations were just like they always were. Basically, like whenever we would talk on the phone, he'd be like, you know, how'd you play? It was always about basketball. It was always about like staying positive. And like, he's like his first question when I came up, so did we clinch the bye? Like, when's the tournament? You know, we need to kick these motherfuckers' asses. Like that was how he was talking to me. And then, you know, just, I don't even remember exactly what the quote unquote last words were, but just like, you know, just, I love you. And like, I believe in you and just keep going. You know, he was just his normal self. You know, he was just Chip. Unbreakable fighter spirit is all like, that's the way I can remember it. You know, just like unbreakable and unfazable pretty much.
Is Oakland your alma mater? Like, here's my question with guys that are two-time transfers. Like, do you have a home? Is Oakland a place like, oh, that's where I went to school?
Yeah, I claim Oakland for sure. I had a great opportunity, I had a great experience there. You know, my senior year was a great experience. keep in touch with Coach Campy, keep in touch with my teammates, mostly from there. So I definitely claim Oakland, I would say.
The G League, what was your experience like?
Brief, you know, it was brief, but exposure to pro basketball, you know, exposure to the cutthroat nature, you know, if you don't play well and you don't show what you need to show pretty much right away, you know, you can be cut. And another step up for me, and I was a G League first round draft pick and lasted just a couple games with the team and got cut, but then later in the season got brought back to the team. So just the way that the game is, the rosters and everything is so in flux, everything's changing, and to it gives me an appreciation for some of these guys who make it not as a first totally. Round draft pick, and you know, who have the perseverance. Like it takes a lot of resilience to really get it done, especially at the highest of levels, in terms of how good you got to be and how consistent you got to be. And then, all right, you did that. Now, what can you do for me now? It's always, you know, it's always about the present. No one cares what you've done in the past. Can you continue to do that at a high level? And being exposed to that, I think it helps my perspective now as a coach, especially coaching professionals, just understanding the grind and the expectations that go into it.
If you were to, there's kids all over, you know, I do think shooting's better now than it was when I was a kid, or maybe when you were a kid. 100%. Steph Curry told me, he's like, look, one of the reasons is I've never been on a basketball court that didn't have a 3-point line. Mm-hmm. And so, and it just, you know, kids shoot it more. But how, like your routine, when you did your shooting routine, how many shots, for example, how many shots did you shoot in a day?
Well, when I was coming up in high school and early in college, I would get on the shooting machine. I would aim to make 500 threes every day. What I kind of had to learn was it wasn't about just drilling shots in one place. Cause like we've talked about, the game is so like, you know, it's dynamic, you know, like you said, mm-hmm. Joe Harris can't just stand in the corner and make threes. He's making threes with probably doing off the dribble or moving into them, and guys are contesting it. So for me, I was the gym rat who always shot and shot and shot and shot. But then, all right, how do I apply this? Like, how do I become an assassin in the game? And then that was number one, doing shooting drills on the move, sprinting into shots, footwork, you know, making sure my turns are right and everything, different angles. And then it's just going out and playing, playing ball, but playing freely. Maybe playing a little bit more loose than you would play in a normal game, and pushing that envelope in terms of how can I get my shot off, you know. And that was a big thing that helped me at St. John's, was being able to get shots off against high level athletes. You know, I wasn't the didn't have the quickest feet, you know, so I had to be smart and had to be precise and, you know, learn to use my footwork to get my shot off. So getting my shot off, that was a bigger challenge. I knew once I got them off, I could make them. I just had to consistently be able to get them off.
And then what about the mentality? Because like, you're going to go through, guys go through where you can't make a shot. How do you fight through that confidence wise?
Yeah. The mentality, I think early in my career, I was like a mental midget. You know what I mean? Like I would miss one and just get tightened up, and confidence would be lacking. But I think when things clicked for me, and what led to my senior year was truly just caring less, you know, just like a miss I didn't care. You know what I mean? Like I was honestly, and what really made it click for me was like, hey man, my dad is sick with cancer. I got one more year left of college. I don't have shit to lose. Like if I miss, if I airball, I'm doing what I do. You know, I have nothing to lose. And kind of when your back is against the wall, you know, some people rise to the occasion. And I think that's when that mentality clicked in place for me. Like, hey, just trust yourself and do what you do. Like offensively, you can't think too much. You got to react and just flow. And once I really tapped into that and basically the fuck it mentality of being able to, you know, shoot those shots. And if you miss, okay, everyone misses. Like you said, Steph Curry misses more often than he makes. Like, I mean, that's what it was all about for me, is getting that mentality to click into place. But it's easier said than done. A lot easier said than done.
No question. And I think the smarter you are, the more your brain challenges you. Because you overthink. My thing was, I hated to come out of games, and I felt like it was the only thing that would keep me out, take me out of games, because I would miss a shot. I'd miss it. And it would just get in my head. Like I can, mm-hmm. I can shoot. I just was so in my own head about every different shot. And it's something that I've really worked on with my own son. Just like, you know, we got to be process, not result. Right. Was it a good shot? Did you have your feet set? Did you have your hands right? Did you feel like it was going to go in? Then fuck it. You know, like you are not going to make every shot. I hate to open the floor for the first time last week. I was like standing up and like, this is the first time he's soft Newport Beach kid. And he got getting a little grimy.
I love it. We need that. We need that.
Right. Ultimate goal, head coach in the NBA or front office?
Head coach, 100%. You know, it's a path, obviously, but I'm on rung one of the ladder, you know, but I'm like, my whole life,
look, dude. I mean, Vogel video guy, Spoelstra video guy. They were in the NBA finals, right? Like, it's that's the path.
Yeah, I mean, it's not unattainable, you know. And I believe, I mean, when I'm up till 3 a.m., like, I'll be up late tonight working on the Phoenix game. Like, I'm doing it with long term development in mind. You know, I'm not just going through the motions. Like, I really want to. You know, I eat, sleep, and breathe this stuff, and I really, really want to do it. You know, I want to be a head coach. College head coach would be great as well. You know, you learn so much in the NBA. College head coach would be great. Recruiting is a different thing, but I mean, for me, like, this is where my passion lies, and I don't see anything else that I would want to do. I feel like this is what I want to pour myself into. And always it was pouring myself into playing in the NBA, and now it's like, hey, just flip that switch, and now it's just pour all that passion and drive into being the best coach I can be.
It's pretty amazing though. Like, here's where we're similar. Like, you know, so much of our lives are spent in a car with our dads, going to a basketball game and them kind of supporting us. And like, basketball has provided me this incredible lifestyle, right? Life. And it's starting to do the same for you. And I think there's thousands of us around the country that are like that, right? Which, like, all you want to do is help your kid achieve his dream. And all the kid wants to do is have the dad who helps them. And it's pretty amazing to see. I mean, I'm sure your dad is so proud of you right now, probably more proud of you than he was when you were hooping in Oakland. When you kicked those motherfuckers' asses, like,
exactly. You should have. How many threes did you make? That was always the question.
How many threes did you make?
Yeah.
The most you made in a game ever was where? Was what?
High school, 11. And in college, I had 9 in a game.
Against who?
It was against Green Bay. It was actually a road trip. I went 7 for 10 and 9 for 14 in back-to-back games. Those were my two blow-up games. And so that's 16 made threes in 2 games. Kay Felder assisted 15 of them. And the one he didn't, he was fouled out, and I had to take it off the dribble one, so no one assisted it. So he and I, we had some good synergy. I owe him a lot.
Yeah, that's and Greg Campy. You know, the master of the sweater,
100%.
Big sweater. He's a big sweater guy.
Upper echelon sweater game. Unreal.
Yeah. Is it the same sweater all the time, or are they different sweaters?
Different.
They look the same.
Different. But if anyone hasn't seen it, Google Greg Hampy, Christmas, ugly Christmas sweater. He had the one with the reindeer that came out the chest and out of his back. So that was a.
That's big time. Incredible. That's solid.
Yeah.
The glamours of the video room. People ask all the time, like, well, video room is all you got to do to get into the NBA. Your life is how much basketball do you watch during a day?
I mean, it depends on when you're prepping for a game, but like, it's pretty much a video guy. You're always doing something because, like I said, it's 5 games. So you don't scout. I don't scout every single team, but I scout every one out of every 2 to 3 games. And so Portland plays their last game of that 5. We play Portland on Friday, so I'll be finishing my Portland report today. Then we play Phoenix next week, and I'm already on game 3 of Phoenix. So like, you're concurrently working on those teams, and you're digging deep into those. So I mean, like you said, oh, don't you just have to break down the games? It's like, I mean, yeah, but I don't know if everyone would be willing to, like, tonight I'm probably going to be up till 2 or 3 a.m. breaking down the Phoenix game because it's a West Coast game. So I'm not sure that everyone's going to be willing to do that every single night, you know? So you right. got to love
that. Plus, you know, you make a couple $100,000 doing it. So, you know, close to $1 million doing it. Right.
I wish. Yeah. It's the starting level, you know, it's the entry level position. It's the barrier to entry. You know, you got to get in and do it. So.
Last thing. If you were to 17-year-old Max, you were to give him one piece of advice, what would it be?
I would say if you have one direction you want to go in, like, trust it, you know, like, don't second guess. And I don't think I did that, but I think it would say trust it and kind of, I guess the saying that everyone likes to say it now is like, bet on yourself. But it's real, you know, like, if you, like, people, there was definitely some backlash or negativity, just, why'd you want to leave Harvard or why'd you want to leave St. John's? And it was just like, I was just trusting myself. You know, I felt like that was the right move for me. And I didn't need to appease anyone. You know, I was doing what I felt like was best.
But I also think, though, that what you discovered at Oakland is a big key, which is, like, we all worry about levels of school and prestige of school, which I do think is important. Like, you know, like, look, if you had a Harvard degree right now, like, it doesn't suck. It's not a bad decision. But go somewhere you're going to play. Right? Yeah. If you're not a basketball player, it's okay. Go somewhere you're going to get a great degree or going to have a good time.
Or go to school. Have fun.
Right.
You know,
if you're a hooper, right? I always have shoes and a ball in my car. I love playing basketball. If you're really a hooper, go somewhere you're going to play, because you're not going to be happy if you're not playing. And go somewhere where somebody like you with Travis Bader, right? Somebody who plays like you has had success. Because, yeah. You know, I can't tell you how many times guys I was recruited by that, like, I give you one. So Kevin O'Neill recruited me to Tennessee.
Hmm.
And Lawrence Frank was his assistant. And this, I transferred from Notre Dame, and they had just gotten the job. And they literally would just carpet bomb you with letters every day.
Sure.
And I never forget, like, we want to play fast and get athletes and go up and down. And I never forget, like, I click on the game, they're playing Kentucky, and they got like 14 at the half, you know, and they're holding the ball. Now, they had to at that point in time because they didn't have dudes. But it's more the idea of, like, yeah, that's not me. Whereas when I went to Oklahoma State, granted, I was much more athletic and not as good a shooter as Sean Sutton. But I had seen him have different point guards kind of like me have success. And part of it was I had to see it. I had to see their team to go, like, oh, if you move this guy to the two and this guy to the three and Desmond Mason from the three to the four, like, oh, now all of a sudden we got a team and I can dime them up. Like, we can go. But I do think that it's trusting your basketball instincts, going somewhere you can play.
Yeah.
Is, you know, and that's when you can bet on yourself. Bet on yourself at a place where you feel like you can get the opportunity. And if you get the opportunity, you're not any good. Like, all right, well, then you figure out what's next. But
yeah,
sitting over there wanting that opportunity just sucks. That's a hard feeling.
Yeah, and I think there's two ways you can play it, because you can use basketball as a vehicle. You know, let's say you want to go to XYZ school and basketball helps you get in. And your basketball experience is what it is, but you have a great experience. You live in a city you love. You get a great degree. You build a network, you know, alumni network. So, I mean, that can be your motivation. But like you said, if you're the dude with the ball and the shoes in the trunk, and, you know, you want to give your best shot of being a pro and, you know, making basketball your existence, more or less, then you got to go where the shoe fits. You know, you, even if you're a specialist, I see that on the coaching side, like, and I start to think about, hey, how would I utilize this guy? Or, like, what actions would this guy, you know, look good off of? Or how can we use this guy defensively? And because you're trying to maximize each player and in turn use that to maximize the team. So, like, if Kay Felder would have squeaked out a scholarship to Michigan State, would he have done what he did at Oakland? Of course not. You know what I mean? He would have been behind guys, you know, in the rotation. Instead, he goes to Oakland, plays 36 minutes a game as a freshman, plays 39 minutes a game as a sophomore, grows and develops, and it is an NBA draft pick, you know? So, like, fit is really the only thing that matters, kind of, because you got to have a coach who has your back and who's going to put you in the spots to succeed.
Great stuff, man. Listen, good to catch up. Glad you're well.
Always and, a pleasure. It's been too long, you know. It's always a pleasure.
I know. I will be in Boston this summer, whether you're there. And if you're in LA, I know you have tons of friends here too, but we gotta hang. And I gotta get you my little guy. I gotta get you my little guy a little shooting lesson.
I'd love that. That'd be fun. Keep me posted on his progress.
I definitely will. That will. Thanks for joining me.
Appreciate you.
Wasn't that great? Wasn't that interesting? Right? Like, we talked NBA stuff, then we talked about his life and about fit. Oh man, that was awesome stuff. A reminder, if you like my way of doing things, you can listen to the Doug Gottlieb Show, 3 to 6 Eastern, 12 to 3 Pacific, on Fox Sports Radio, the iHeartRadio app. You can also send me a tweet at Gottlieb Show. Anything you'd like me to get into or comment on All Ball, remember to subscribe, rate, review, write a review. That would be awesome. In the meantime, thanks so much for listening. I'm Doug Gottlieb. This is All Ball.